Welcome to Encrypted. This is Lorette Love. My co-host is David Redding. Hey, David.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, Lorette?
Great. So our guest today is Chuck Zukowski, and he's with UFONet.com, really cool website. He's just on the History or the Science Channel, sorry, their new show, which is a really great show, The Unexplained Files. And Chuck was on episode 3, so check that out. And, Dave, tell us a little bit about Chuck. Do you have some info on him?
Yeah, Chuck Zukowski, he's a microchip designer and former volunteer deputy sheriff. He's been investigating UFOs and the paranormal for the past 28 years and has been featured on many TV and radio shows discussing his investigations. Chuck addresses each investigation as a skeptic by looking at the evidence and eliminating all plausible explanations pertaining to it. Then he focuses on the non-plausible to reach his conclusions. This technique generally solidifies his work by generating new discoveries. And I want to welcome Chuck to our show.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate being on. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, thank you for being here. Now, tell us about your work. It's paranormal, Bigfoot, a lot of different areas you cover.
You know, I started off as a crash retrieval investigator, Aztec, Roswell, and a few other places across the U.S. kind of investigating that. And as it turns out, that it almost appears that one investigation, there's commonalities with other investigations. With UFOs, Bigfoot pops up. With UFOs, cattle mutilations or animal mutilations pops up. With alien abductions, ghosts pop up. So, over the period of almost 3 decades now, I've been kind of, venturing out in different avenues and different levels of paranormal. Actually, paranormal is by definition anything other than normal. But I always like to put paranormal and UFO because most people think paranormal is just ghosts. That's not true. Paranormal is really anything that's other than what we consider normal. But in today's society, there's a lot of not normal things going on out there, and there's a lot of investigating to be done.
Right. Well, so, and I think the show on the History Channel, Science Channel, Unexplained Files, they talk a lot about the mutilation of animals, and how do you know that it's not just some nut going out there and hurting the animals for attention?
That's a very, very good question. And a lot of times, that's really the very first question that we ask when we go to an animal mutilation, or I ask in particular, when I talk to the ranchers, when I talk to, the cattle agents or the Association with Cattle Association, people working with them. It's basically something we look at what evidence or lack of evidence, appears to be associated with this mutilation. Now, really, just because there may be a lack of evidence that, human or something's involved doesn't mean that evidence is lacking. It's just that we have to be very, very creative on how to look for the evidence that's there. I mean, everything that, touches one animal, touches another, or any type, if you look at this like a homicide, there's always some type of evidence left behind. Unfortunately, these cases, the evidence is very, very unclear. It's been going on since 1967, at least, actually before that, but the very first case out here in Colorado went public in 67 in Alamosa. And since then, we've had over 10,000 cases of animal mutilations just across the U.S. alone. And since 1967, no law enforcement agency not only in the U.S., but other parts of the world, have been able to locate or actually catch a human involved with this. And cops are very, very good at looking for human evidence in any type of a crime or a homicide. And these are crimes. These are animal cruelty crimes. But when I start with animal mutilation cases, and I know Halloween's just around the corner, and really, to be honest with you, out of Bigfoot and ghost investigations and alien abductions, animal mutilations is pretty scary. You're looking at an animal that was alive, 24 hours before, and it's drained of blood. There's no, you had these unusual markings, these cuts all over it. This thing was killed. I mean, it's a homicide. It's an animal homicide. And there was just no evidence of how this was, how this happened. And the past 3-4 years, I've been working with law enforcement agencies also across the U.S. trying to help them, giving them enough information to try to address this. But the first thing we look at is basically, when you talk to the rancher, these ranchers are second, third generation ranchers. So, they know when one of their animals is dead due to uncommon circumstances, and that scares them. So basically, how do we know that the cults aren't doing this, or transients, or anything like that? It's because we're all human, and humans make mistakes. Basically, sometime between 67 and 2013, someone would have effed up. We would have found, some type of a human intervention, and that's not the case. We have not found any yet. So that kind of eliminates, commonalities of humans associated with that. I'm not saying it's alien. I've never seen any evidence that points to alien, but I've never seen any evidence pointing to humans either. So,
right. So what's your take on it then? What do you think?
That's a really good question too. And basically, I have to be very analytical about my investigations, and I do address these things as a slight skeptic, not so much a debunker, but as a slight skeptic. I eliminate all common type of evidence first, or commonalities that we may see in a natural environment on a ranch. You kind of eliminate all that first, and then you start looking at the things that are not normal. I can tell you this. The animal is actually picked up from location A, it's taken to a location B, and it's mutilated, drained of blood and the unusual cuts and whoever's doing it does it there. And then they bring it back to location C. Location C is close to location A, but not really that. It could depend. It could be a quarter mile. Well, not a quarter mile. It could be, a couple hundred yards away, as close as even, 30 yards away. But who's ever doing it picks it up, takes it to another location, does what they need to do, and then they kind of bring it back. And there's a couple of theories based on that if you want to look at human intervention as opposed to alien, of why that's being done. But my theory is, at this time it's an unknown predator, and it's a scary unknown predator because there actually have been some couple of cases in the past where humans were involved. Although when humans are involved, it's considered homicides, and a lot of the information we get from those cases are pretty much locked up. Because it's a human involved, it's a homicide. There's a lot of litigation involved in that, so a lot of it's hearsay. But with aliens, with animal mutilations, it pertains, to horses, cows, goats, sheep, dogs. You kind of name it. It's a little bit easier for us to investigate because humans aren't involved.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying there are humans that are hurt and killed also the same way these animals are?
There have been a couple of cases of human intervention, where there was a case, I think it was in South America. I'll have to check that out. But basically, we heard a case in Tennessee. We heard about a case in Canada because it's considered a homicide that you know, we don't really get a lot of information about those. So it's a little bit easier to work on animals, obviously. But, you know, in the back of our mind, we have to look at the fact that maybe, you know, humans can be involved. Now, what's scary about this, and here's something that's kind of, this is where we start getting into some really scary things about not only animal mutilations, but what's going on out here in the U.S. FBI statistics back in 2006 stated close to 2,600 people a week in the U.S. alone disappear without a trace. These are FBI statistics. So, you know, we may have close to 800,000 people disappearing in the United States alone yearly. Scary stuff. So when you hear about these cases of possible, you know, human mutilations, or you hear about other things, too, happening in other parts of the world, we at least have to be aware of what can actually happen based on, you know, statistics. Now, obviously, people disappearing weekly, there's a lot of reasons for that. They just choose to. In other cases, they don't choose to, and they just disappear. And, you know, like I said, this is some really scary stuff. Animal mutilation investigation is not for, the average investigator. I taught an investigative class earlier this year in Las Vegas for Mutual UFO Network, and I told them, I said, this is dangerous stuff. This is scary stuff, and you've got to know what you're doing before you can, you know, address it.
Right.
And then you got to watch your back.
At all. Yeah, it's a very, for me, difficult to talk about because I love animals, and yeah. So I never thought of that as a connection with the missing people. A friend of mine just did a fundraiser for the human trafficking thing, to stop human trafficking. I know that's like a huge sort of industry, I guess.
Absolutely. And the missing people that happen weekly, you know, that happen across, not only here in the U.S., but across the world. Human trafficking, I know, is a big part of that. Like, you know, like in the introduction, I was a volunteer deputy for about 8 years out here in Colorado. So we did get a lot of information coming down, you know, through law enforcement to help us with anything that happened out here in Colorado. So we do know that human trafficking is probably part of that. And there are homicides involved with that and all kinds of things. But we also have to think about those cases where maybe these people disappear and it's unexplainable, like animal mutilation. I don't want to say that that's actually the case. It's just that you, as an investigator, you have to be open to all possibilities. And, you know, that's one of them, too. When you do these investigations, you got to really be careful of what you're doing and how you address it, because something killed a 1,000-pound animal, took it down pretty darn quick, you know, and did whatever it wanted to do with it and left it there with no trace at all. So, you know, if they can do that to large animals, a human, you know, would be no problem at all.
Right.
Yeah. You said that they were drained of the, you know, the animals were drained of their blood. Large animals, they have a lot of blood, correct?
About 4.5 gallons.
Okay, that's where I'm getting at. Have you ever found any evidence of the remaining blood anywhere in any of these cases?
No, and that's what's really interesting, too, is these animals, when we find them, they'll be laying, you know, in a rancher's field somewhere. And the very first thing that I look at when I come to a case of animal mutilation, first thing you look at is you look at the animal itself. Obviously, look to see if there's any traces of massive amount of blood around it. Because if these large animals are taken down by a predator, there's going to be evidence that the animal, there was some type of fighting or scuffle or something. We don't see any evidence like that at all. And we don't see any massive amount of blood. We don't see any abrasions, contusions. Puncture marks, scrape marks, hemorrhaging, nothing like that. We just see an animal laying on the ground with these unusual marks as if it was placed there. Now, what's interesting is just recently, you know, you talked about that. I was on the Science Channel Unexplained Files, and I went to their website. The production company, they're out of England, the ones that filmed this particular episode, And I went to the Science Channel website, and the production company, Raw TV, actually did this, you know, this outtake of some of the mutilation footage that they shot in England. And one of them was, you know, they had an animal that they cut up a little bit to use as, well, it was already dead, obviously, but we probably couldn't get away with that doing it here in the U.S., but, you know, they did that in England. And they took this animal and they dropped it from a forklift. And when I was watching that, I realized that I kind of missed something over my years of investigation, that when they dropped this 1,000-pound animal, there was a little bit of a bounce there. And I went, oh, how in the hell did I, you kind of don't think about stuff like that. You just see an animal laying there. Now, one of the things I was looking for was a lack of movement of the animal, that, you know, that there was, you know, any animal that gets killed, it's going to move a little bit. It's going to twitch. It's going to do something. We don't see any evidence at all. You know, the hooves or the head or anything is actually moving in the ground, you know, as it's dying, cardiac arrest or anything. It's just laying there. And so one of the things we look at is that it looked like it was possibly dropped. And there are cases where the rib cages have been broken and the ribs in the rib cage have been broken. And there's impact craters where the animal was laying and it was been dropped. But now, because of this episode I was on and because of their outtakes, I realized that I originally thought these things were dropped, but they're not dropped. They're placed. So kind of picture your hand, kind of picture an invisible hand holding an animal and forcing it to the ground and placing it there, because there's no bouncing evidence at all. So what or whoever's doing it, they're not dropping these things like we originally thought. They're coming from a height. We know that they're being placed in these areas. But they're being placed under a controlled force, and not just dropped. So this is stuff that we learn, you know, with every investigation, with every TV show that I work with. I learn more because we try to do some of these reenactments, and this is something that's really new now. This is something that I, you know, that one of my latest, not really a theory. It kind of falls upon the evidence that we see that these things are placed. So now you go back to what do we have as technology? You know, do we have some type of a force field or tractor beam? If you watch Star Trek and these other, you know, shows where they have a tractor beam and they're able to grab one spaceship and pull it towards them or something. Do we have the technology of a tractor beam where we can lift an animal and we can place it back down like an invisible hand? You know, that's what we have to look at. You know, it's some scary stuff.
Yeah, it is. I have one more question about this subject. Why do you think they would want... Let's say it's not an alien bringing it up into spacecraft or whatever, or an alien doing it. How would a human move like a 1,000-pound animal, and why would they want to move a 1,000-pound animal a few feet away to kill it and bring it back a few feet? That doesn't make sense.
And that's a good point. Basically the two theories is this is some secret government, you know, us ops unit that's doing it, and they're doing it for whatever purpose, you know, environmental purposes, of seeing what these animals are taking in from the environment and analyzing that. But it's not only cows, it's horses, it's dogs, it's, you know, it's sheep, it's goats, coyotes. So it's just not a cow that this is happening to. But what they would do is whatever technology they have, they would be able to lift the animal, they'd take it to a second location and cut it up, and then they'd bring it back. And by bringing it back into the general location it was taken from, what they're doing is they're instilling fear into the community by putting this, you know, throwing this unknown caveat into this mutilation event, which kind of forces expectations off of military, you know, onto UFOs or something. And the CIA did this during the 50s, you know, when they were flying these secret airplanes, U-2s and stuff. they were releasing information that, you know, that UFOs were being seen. So basically they were taking the light off of them and throwing it into a whole different atmosphere. And that's what we kind of see that could be one of the theories with this. The problem is we don't have the technology really to do this. If the best of the, and I always like using this now, I hate to use this as an example, but, you know, when we went after bin Laden, we had the best of the best of the best of the special forces went in there. We actually used a stealth helicopter. And what happened? We crashed the stealth helicopter in the compound and had to burn, you know, blow it up and burn it. And that tells you that even the best of the best with the best technology that our military has, you still have problems. You still have human issues. There are errors that happen in any type of event. You know, we had the special forces out a couple weeks ago that were going after a group of individuals, and that event didn't pan out the way they wanted to. They had to retreat. That basically tells you that there are issues with humans being involved in this. But since 67, we've never seen that. So if it's military, it would have to be a group of or a special ops group that is so far more advanced than we've ever seen in our own military that's been able to pull this off and not leave any evidence. Now if you take the other theory about aliens doing this, one of the main theories that we look at is hybrids. Whatever they're doing, they're using the materials and the technology, or not the technology, they're using the materials from the animal and possibly, you know, the bovine hemoglobin, creating serum, bovine serum to help, you know, with their hybrid. That's the other theory. And some people think, well, that's kind of goofy. Well, not really, because back in the 70s, we actually used bovine serum, bovine hemoglobin, for our own in vitro fertilization techniques. The humans, you know, well, we did, our scientists did, from virtual fetal fertilization until they decided, you know, we need to come up with something else because they don't want to introduce any type of animal viruses into a you know, a human baby. But back in the 40s during World War II, you know, our government, our military was looking into using bovine hemoglobin on a battlefield because bovine blood can be used in a human and you don't have to refrigerate it like human blood. So there are some interesting things about cow blood that theory-wise could be used, and we have used in vitro fertilization for hybrid purposes. So you have to, as a UFO investigator, we have to leave at least that option fully wide open, that could be a plausible case. Human intervention seems less and less now. I usually tell most people that I lean more towards aliens doing this than the humans, and the reason for that is because of the lack of evidence. Statistic analysis would tell you that a human would leave some type of evidence, you know, since 1967, and there would be some law enforcement agency somewhere that would be able to find that. So it's really difficult to, you know, to pinpoint exactly who's doing it. So you just have to leave these options open. And cover your back.
Well, the big difference I see, though, is when the humans were doing it, we disposed of the dead animal. We didn't just lay it back down where we found it.
You know, exactly. Now, this is one of the things that I have an issue with. There was a Christopher O'Brien was doing an animal mutilation investigations out here in Colorado a few years ago, and he was on the episode briefly on the Science Channel. And one of his theories was, you know, basically that whoever was doing it was checking the animals for, mad cow disease. And that's why they were doing it. The problem with that is that the FDA does that already. And if you look at our own organizations here in the U.S., that they will come in if they think that there might be a ranch that has, you know, animals that are dying due to unusual viruses. They have the authority, or they'll just come right in and just start taking animals and doing their own not research, but you know, testing on them. So we don't have that. We don't have to worry about the military coming and testing their animals. We have organizations right here in the U.S. that do it anyway, and they have the authority to go on any ranch without the rancher's approval, basically, and test the animals because, you know, these animals are being used for, you know, a food source. So it just doesn't make sense that, you know, the military would be doing this for that particular reason, to protect us. That doesn't make sense at all. We already do it. We do it almost on a regular basis.
Every day, 80 children and adults are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Know the warning signs. Extreme thirst, frequent urination, sudden weight loss. For more information, go to jdrfbayarea.org. That's jdrfbayarea.org. As many as 3 million children and adults have type 1 diabetes. Join JDRF and help support the research that is delivering better treatments and ultimately a cure. Go to JDRFBayArea.org.
Well, is there anything else you want to say to tie up this subject before I go on to something else? Or?
Oh, no, you know, no, not at all. It's just that these animal mutilation cases, I mean, we just had a bunch of sheep that were mutilated in Port Lavaca, Texas, about a week and a half ago, and that made the news. Poor rancher out there lost like 30-some sheep, you know, within this year alone. I was just talking to a rancher last week about an animal that went missing, and he's still looking for it. He's had mutilation cases. The other thing, is what I wanted to kind of say is this isn't something that's happened years ago that we're still investigating. This is stuff that's happening right now. It is probably happening now as we speak. Unfortunately, these ranchers that lose these animals, all these animals that I've investigated are free-grazing animals. So, you know, they're not corralled. They don't stay in one place. You can't put cameras out there because the animals, you know, they're all over the place. And you just can't catch, you know, who's ever doing this because they're free-grazing animals. But these are cases that are happening today, and we still don't have, you know, we don't have an idea. Well, you know, we found some pretty cool evidence. I can touch on that real quick. Some of the things that I found due to, when you do investigations at all, any type of animal mutilations or Bigfoot or ghosts, you know, as an investigator, you have to really think way, way outside the box, and you have to try new techniques on trying to find the evidence. Now, from law enforcement, we have hundreds and hundreds of books of how to do homicides and how to do homicide cases. But when you look at paranormal, we really don't have a library of things that we can look at to kind of figure out how to do things properly. And so we kind of write this stuff as we go along, and you really have to be creative with it. Now, one of the cases, actually, ever since the first case I started investigating animal mutilations, I was using an EMF meter, basically the same type of meters that you see on Ghost Hunters and other shows on TV where you're looking for electromagnetic fields. And so I've been able to take up a baseline of what an animal with electromagnetic field based on microteslas is. But I've had a couple of cases where I've had some really, really high readings telling me that there is an unusual electromagnetic field associated with that animal. One particular animal, so much so, it was twice the Earth's magnetic field. So we're starting to see some really, really unusual evidence based on things like that. I had another case where Well, actually, I've had four cases here in Colorado where these animals were laying in a round ground depression anywhere from between 16 to 22 feet in diameter, almost like a crop circle, and the animals laying in the middle of it. And I've taken soil samples from inside that circle and outside the circle at a test site, and I've had lab analysis done on the soil. And the soil inside the circle, the nutrients have actually been altered, have been changed. And the soil is less soluble compared to the soil outside. Now, not only have I seen that here, but I've actually ran analysis on soil that came from the Kansas City mutilation case in Kansas City, Missouri, and then there was a mutilation case in Georgia, and we're seeing the same thing. So it's just not happening. We're not seeing the same results here just in Colorado. I'm seeing it in other parts of the U.S. too, where we're having these unusual nutrient changes. And the only reason why I've done that is, you just have to be creative and try and think of how in the heck I can find this unknown evidence. There's evidence there. I know the evidence is there. We just have to know how to figure it out. Last week I picked up a full spectrum camera. So the next time I go to a mutilation case, I'll be using a full spectrum camera. I have a white light filter for it, so I'll be able to shoot full spectrum IR and UV during the daytime, looking for evidence that our eyes can't see, that are in the UV or IR mode. So, and I'm kind of excited to do that. Unfortunately, I don't want an animal to be killed before I go do that. But that'll be another tool that I'll be using to try and find this evidence. Like I said, it's not that there's a lack of evidence. It's just or the evidence is lacking. It's just that we can't find the evidence. We know the evidence is there. We just have to figure out, where it is and what it is.
But it's pretty interesting stuff. Physical evidence,
right? Yeah, yeah. And we know there's evidence out there. When you brush against another person in the hallway, you just left evidence on that other person. Depending on how much time you spend with that person, you're leaving more and more evidence. So we know evidence is there. We just got to figure out, what it is and how to find it. So you try a couple different, things to look for that. So, and that's how I'm starting to get a little bit better and better at animal mutilations. I go a little bit outside the box and try and be creative on how to find this stuff rather than what, other investigators have done and they're still doing, which is basically just taking pictures and making assumptions. I'm going one step further. And I'm getting into the science side of it to see if we can figure out what's going on.
Have you ever tried using dogs, like bloodhounds, to see if they could find anything surrounding the animal that's been slaughtered?
That's a really good question. One of the investigators that I've dealt with in the past, actually, they actually, recommended doing that, getting a bloodhound or something. The problem is a lot of these cases, unless you know for sure that this animal you're looking at had died under unnatural causes, this is where the scary part comes in, you can come across an animal that maybe died of a virus, and if you have your dog there or you touch it and you don't think, if you go at it without any type of precognition that there could be an issue with that animal, you could actually get the virus yourself. You can bring the virus home. You could bring home all this stuff to your family. And the first thing a dog's going to do is dogs can come right up and start sniffing it. I've seen, rancher's dogs come up, and one rancher's dog in particular, got in and was eating a little bit of the carcass and got extremely ill, almost died within about 2 weeks or 2 days later, and came up. So whatever happened to the animal, affected that dog. So we have to be careful not only for ourselves and for our team, but when we get into a situation like that, there's certain things we have to look at to make sure that this fits the criteria that's of an actual mutilation and not of a natural death due to poisoning or due to viruses or due to something like that.
Yeah,
that dog would know any different, and unless you control that dog, you could just infect that dog knowingly.
But in the case like Dave was bringing up, where all the blood's gone, and that's pretty much somebody did that, then you could bring a dog in, I was thinking, you know, to...
Well, that's the case. Yeah, you have to bring the dog in after that. But the problem is, and I've worked with dogs before. I've worked with them. I wasn't a handler, but with the law enforcement, I've had to work some SWAT cases where the dogs were there. Dogs are trained to do particular things. So you would have to. How would you train a bloodhound? I mean, how a bloodhound works basically is you give your dog something from the suspect that you're tracking. Here's a piece of this shirt. Here's a piece of what something or other, and he picks up a smell from that. And that's how he tracks. And so you would have to look at a dog now. You would have to train a dog in such a way to look for unknown evidence. You see what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
And that's a problem we have. That's a problem we have with training dogs. It would have to be such a dog that it would be intuitive that it would just say, you know what, something's not right here. Now, that has been the case a couple of times with ranchers' dogs. The problem with that is when a dog feels that there's something unright around about that environment, the dog won't even go near it. And I've seen ranchers' dogs, some cases where, you know, and that's also UFO sightings too that I've investigated, where you know the animals shy away from that, and they won't even go near it. So it's not a bad idea. It's just we'd have to try and figure out how to train a dog to be able to utilize the dog to its best potential for this. I'm open for ideas.
Yeah, okay, great. All right, so we're going to switch gears a little bit here. And, Dave, should we take a break, or are we just going to keep going? What do you think?
I'm fine to keep going.
Okay.
I'm enjoying this.
Right. Okay, cool. So, Chuck, why don't you tell us about Bigfoot and your research into Bigfoot?
You know, I love Bigfoot investigations. I really do. One of my investigations from last year was featured on Animal Planet's Finding Bigfoot. I think it was February this year. It was the Bailey, Colorado sighting in which two women were just out hiking at about 7 o'clock or so at night. It was nice out, and they heard this tree snap or this branch snap and looked up, and here's this Bigfoot go running by. And he was close enough where they could see the discoloration in his hair. As Bigfoot get older, they do gray a little bit, so they could see the dark color, and they could see some graying. That's how close they were. It's pretty cool. We get a lot of, you know, we get a lot of sightings out here in Colorado. I've done a few investigations out here. My smoking gun for me was a couple years back when I was hiking up about 10,000 feet, and we came across, and this was in the snow, we came across Bigfoot tracks in the snow. And these tracks, they were a little bit older. You know, they were a couple days old, so they weren't too fresh, but they were 22 inches, you know, long, and they had a 4-foot gait, and it was left, right, left, right. And we followed the tracks off the side of this mountain until they dissipated a little bit. And then you could see evidence that, and what's interesting about Bigfoot is, you know, if you're in an area where Bigfoot has been seen, you can probably find some evidence that it's been there, or he's or she's been there. And they leave trail markers just like we leave trail markers when we go out hiking, except their trail markers are about 8 to 9 feet off the ground. So if you know, for anybody out there listening that you know, want to go out and look for this stuff, you gotta look it up. And you got to look for some really unusual things. What they have the tendency to do, they'll break branches, just like, you know, we would break branches. They'll break them and twist them. So you know that it's just not a broken branch that was just done by, you know, another branch, you know, falling off or something. So they do leave particular trail markers. And then once you start finding trail markers, then you can, and you're aware of what they look like. Then it's kind of easier. to get an idea of the direction they're going. Most of the time, though, they like to stay near water. They like to walk in the water to hide their tracks. They like to be around rocks and stuff where they can, you know, be up on the rocks to hide their tracks. They're very, very intelligent, very, very good at what they do. They've learned stealth very, very well over the, you know, past couple hundred centuries, I guess. They've been out for a while. If you talk to the Native Americans, their ancestors talk about seeing Bigfoot. So, you know, it's not something new. It's been going on for a lot of years. Just fun. And that's what's interesting about that is I'm not afraid of Bigfoot investigations like some people, you know, may think. I've only heard a couple of cases and seen a couple of cases where, you know, individuals were killed possibly due to a Bigfoot, but the circumstances were kind of unusual in one case and the other. Well, actually, both cases were kind of unusual. So most of the time, they'll leave you alone unless you irritate them, and then, you know, they may tell you or might give you some clues to back off.
Right. So what do you think they are? Like a species that died out and there's only a few left, or what do you feel about that?
Well, you know what's cool? If you follow modern day science now, that, you know, the Homo sapiens actually lived around this at the exact same time. I don't know if it was not Cro-Magnon, I forget the actual like Neanderthal, but it appears that we found, or scientists have found, anthropologists have found enough evidence to show that there were two species living at the same time, and Homo sapiens basically killed off, you know, the others, if you want to call them Neanderthals or not. But this is another name because they were actually a little bit more advanced than that. Now, if you have this other aspect of species that got away from, you know, Homo sapiens when they were coming into being, then they could be an offshoot of what Sasquatch is now. We do know, and this is this kind of depends on who you talk to, but when you look at it from the science side of Bigfoot, are basically they appear to be omnivores. They are not nocturnal. So I know if you watch Finding Bigfoot, you listen to Matt Moneymaker, he says these things are nocturnal. That's not true. And I don't know where in the hell he ever got that from. Most of the sightings I've ever heard about are during the daytime, and after midnight or so, you know, these guys bed down somewhere, so they're not really nocturnal. And nothing about the animal, if you look at the animal, says it's nocturnal. Their eyes are forward. I mean, they are the very top of the food chain because their eyes aren't on the side of the head like maybe an antelope or something where you have to worry about, you know, higher predators. They are the highest predator. Their eyes are set forward like ours are. Their ears, they don't have large ears, so they don't have to, you know, hear noise coming up and be afraid of it. I mean, everything about them is very human-like, which tells you that, you know, they're not this nocturnal animal. Now, what's cool about Bigfoot is they've been around for so long, they've been able to adapt to the wilderness that I think they've actually become more intuitive, and their senses have amplified far, far beyond, you know, our senses. Now, unfortunately, we've kind of succumbed to technology in the past 100 or so years, and we're becoming, you know, dumbified. I hate to say that, but we really are becoming dumbified. You know, the more technology we use, I think we're actually de-evolving in some cases. It's pretty interesting. Next time you go to a fast food store and the person behind the counter, you give them a little bit more money, you know, than what they asked for, so you get a full dollar bill back, or you get even change back. They don't know how to figure it out. They've lost the science of arithmetic because they're, you know, or mathematics because they're relying on you know, their cash register to tell you what your change is and stuff. And we're seeing that more and more now, where we're actually, in some cases, de-evolving due to technology. We're becoming too dependent on it. Now, if you look at Bigfoot that lives out in the wilderness, has never been involved too much in technology, they become very heightened in their senses and what's going on out there. Now, every one of us, we have this sixth sense. We have this sense, we call it, in women's cases, we call it women intuition. You know, if someone, and I don't know whether or not you've ever experienced it or not, but, you know, there are some cases where my sister, who's an investigator, or my wife would say, you know, this bugs me. I don't want to be here. I mean, there's that woman's intuition. There's something going on. They picked up on it. And if you listen to that, you just might survive the night.
Mm-hmm.
But
no,
here's,
absolutely.
Here's,
I believe in that.
Yeah, and here's a really good example for your listeners. And I know it's happened to a lot of people. And you're sitting in a car, and you're sitting at a light, and you just got this feeling someone's staring at you. And you look over your shoulder, and the guy or girl in the car beside you or motorcycle, whatever, is staring at you. Now, they were too far out of your peripheral vision for you to see them staring at you, yet you knew that you were being watched. And you looked over, and sure enough, that person was staring at you. This happens all the time. How do we know that? How can we do that? Well, it's that perception that we have. It's that extrasensory perception that we have that we all have. And sometimes it kicks in, sometimes it doesn't. Now, if you have a species that lives outside of technology, and they're in tune to that, you know, to the wilderness, that little bit of perception that we have, that we can, you know, that we know someone's watching us, that's enhanced, and so they're able to pick up that people are walking out. They could be a quarter mile away. They don't need to smell them. They don't need to hear them. They sense them, and that's one of the theories of why it's hard to find, you know, Bigfoot. You know, you almost have to catch them when they want to be caught, when they want to be seen. It's most of the time is what happens, but they would have to be so consumed in something that they're doing that their senses are turned off, so focused on what they're doing, and we do that too sometimes, and that's why we have people wreck their cars all the time because they're texting. They're so focused on their texting that they don't, you know, they don't see what's going on around them, and that's some of the times where Bigfoot will F up. What happened out here last year in Bailey, Colorado, I personally think that this happens. The Bigfoot males, they like human females, and they, you know, and they'll watch you if you're out there hiking. If they're out there and they hear you talking, they're curious, they'll watch you. I think what happened with this particular case of these two women is they were being watched by Bigfoot because there were some occurrences that happened a half hour before that, you know, pine cones being thrown at them and stuff that they didn't really think about. And I think he was so focused on watching me that he accidentally stepped on a branch and broke it, which gave his position away, and then he panicked and took off running.
Oh, no. Well, that's pretty scary that they like human women. Sort of reminds me of the fallen angel thing where the fallen angels are watching women or whatever. That,
well, I tell you, not to eliminate the guys out there, the females like the guys too. Now, if you talk to some of the Native Americans, and I've done some research and talked with Native Americans in the Four Corners region out here in Colorado, and their ancestors have talked about certain cases, in some cases, where there was a human Bigfoot intervention, let's just say, you know, basically crossbreeding in some cases. So, it's really hard to find those stories or cases. You really have to know some elders and be able to talk to the elders, because unfortunately, when they are Native Americans, they don't write a lot of this stuff down, you know, like we do in journals. So a lot of it are stories that are handed up from generation to generation, but there have been some stories that I've heard where there have been some, cross breeding, let's say, between humans and Bigfoot or Native Americans and Bigfoot. Very rare.
But
there is that attraction there.
Before we go, because we haven't taken any breaks, so we're probably going to tack those on at the end. But has there been any real evidence, like hair or blood or something from a Bigfoot? I know I've seen through the years impressions of footprints, but has there been physical evidence of Bigfoot at all?
Well, actually, footprints are physical evidence, and yes, there has been hair. And matter of fact, there was a press release that was done about a week or so ago from a Bigfoot group out of Texas that, you know, that have, they have some droppings and urine samples and stuff, where some of the DNA analysis says it doesn't point to any one particular type of animal. Now, here's another thing, too. DNA, when you're comparing DNA, you have to have something to compare it to. So until you actually have DNA from a known Bigfoot that you can compare your other DNA to, at this point, people are, you know, you're, these labs are just comparing DNA to just, well, you know, it's an ape, or it's not an ape, or it's not a human, or it's sort of like a human. That's how DNA works. You have to be able to compare it to something else. Just to have a DNA strand out there, you know, it's not going to really tell you too much, because the whole basis of it is to be able to compare it to something else. So we do have some, you know, there are hair samples. I've got hair samples here. I've got scat samples from an investigation that happened in Tennessee a few years ago. Unfortunately, some of these places, you know, I've tried to get the Denver Museum, or actually the Denver Zoo or the Colorado Springs Zoo to actually do this, to look at them to see if they can figure out what this is. Most places don't like to do that. So as investigators, we have to be able to fund it ourselves. Like the animal mutilations, I fund all the soil samples and all the, you know, anything that goes to a necropsy or lab. I pay for all that myself. We really don't have an outside budget to do this. But there's as much evidence as we picked up from Bigfoot. If you were to apply that to a homicide, a human homicide, and point it to a particular person, they would get the gas chamber. They would, you know, they would be on death row. There's that much evidence out there. The problem is, you know, people, there's speculation that a Bigfoot does or does not exist. You know, that's problem that we have. They're out there saying, well, you're just chasing ghosts. Well, I've done that too. But I can guarantee you that there are Bigfoot out there. I've seen enough evidence, so much evidence, that it would put someone away for murder if it was a human. But, you know, that's not usually the case when it comes to paranormal. You know, they look at the evidence differently. You know, they have to land in my, UFO's got to land in my front yard. You know, that's what you hear all the time.
All right. Dave, do you have any other questions for Chuck?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Do you have any closing comments or anything, Chuck, before we... leave for this evening?
Well, I appreciate it. Well, first off, I'd like to, you know, thank you for having me on your show. And secondly, for all your listeners out there, I know there's a lot of stuff we kind of covered to, you know, this hour. I moved kind of quick, but I've been doing this for 28 years or so, and I've seen so much that I know there's more to life than just, you know, what we see. And so the next time, you know, any of your listeners, and it kind of, you know, you're outside or even in your house, you know, take a time to just relax, look around you. You might actually see or hear something you can't explain. It happens all the time. We just have to be more in tune to what our surrounding areas are, rather than being so tunnel visioned and so focused on what we're doing on the daily life. Once you open yourself up to other things, you'd be surprised what's out there. It's amazing.
That's cool. That's true. Thank you so much for being our guest. It was wonderful. And hopefully you'll be back on soon.
Yeah. And then if anybody has any questions for me, just go to my website, UFONUT. It's UFONUT.com. Unfortunately, it's called UFO Nut because they used to call me a nut back in the day, so I decided to have fun with it. Go to my website, email me from there, ask me any questions, and I'll get back to you.
Great, and it's a great website, really fun, ufonet.com. Check it out.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you. Okay, Dave, thanks for being on the show with us today, and anything else with any notes, anything you want to discuss, Dave?
No, I'm all good. It's been fun.
Great. All right. See you next time. This is Lorette Love and David Redding with Encrypted.
Long before you and I were ever born, a mystery was hidden. A code was devised. A secret was guarded. It is encrypted. The truth about the Holy Grail. Who is 666? What is the elixir of life? What really happened on 12/21/12? What astonishing secret is hidden in the Declaration of Independence? What if everything you learned about history, everything you believed about reality, everything you trusted for your future is a lie? What if the truth is encrypted? EncryptedTheBook.com.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.